Welcome to Friday Forum. My name is Stephen Spitz. 30 years ago, Carl Sagan stunned the scientific world with his estimate based on the Drake equation that there are more than 1 million intelligent civilizations in our galaxy alone. Since there are hundreds of billions of galaxies, and each with billions of stars, there could be as many as 10 trillion intelligent civilizations in the universe. Today we are again exploring space to see if this is true and if there's life out there somewhere. Joining me to discuss space exploration and life in the universe are Carl Agee, director of UNM's Institute of Meteoritics, is that right?
That's right.
And Carl has worked on sample returns from the moon and is just back from a conference on the Mars rovers. Carl Agee, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
And we're also very pleased to have on the show Harrison Schmidt. Harrison was the scientist astronaut on Apollo 17. I understand he was the last man to have stood on the moon. And he's also a former United States senator from New Mexico. Harrison, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. And to be absolutely accurate, I was the last person to step on the moon.
Last person to step on the moon.
Yeah, my colleague Gene Cernan had to get off last.
Okay. So I'd like to start with this question, Carl. Why Mars? There seems to be such an emphasis on exploring Mars and taking a look at Mars. Why? What's the reason for that?
I think the major reason is, first and foremost, the search for life elsewhere. And Mars being another rocky terrestrial body in the solar system similar to Earth, that's sort of one of the main targets, a place where it's most likely to either have existed in the past or maybe even exist currently.
And as I mentioned, you've recently come back from a 3-day conference on the results of the rovers thus far. And I'm wondering what you learned at this conference.
Well, yes,
about what the rovers have found.
It was actually a meeting that's organized by the Mars Program Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And it covered the Mars Exploration Rover missions that are going on now. But also, it's a forum where scientists and engineers can help plan the upcoming missions and the sort of where we're headed next for Mars. And so there are lots of really interesting findings about Mars from the exploration rovers, like it's really clear now that there were standing bodies of water on the surface of Mars at some time in the past. And we see these basins that have where the water has evaporated out of. And so anyway, by looking at the current way of exploration and what we've learned, we're sort of setting, trying to understand what's next. What are the important next steps? Orbiters, landers, rovers, sample return missions, and so on, in order to try to answer this question about whether there's life on Mars.
Well, since can I bring you into the conversation?
Well, I just would add that really, from a planetary geologist's perspective, which I always try to present. There has been little or no doubt since the Viking orbiter photography in the 1970s, in the 70s, that Mars had been a wet planet. And what we've had since then are periodic reaffirmations of that by other types of sensors. But if you had asked Mike Carr or other planetary geologists, Munch and the like, back in the late 1970s, was Mars a wet planet at one time? They would have said unequivocally yes. And in fact, they were making estimates on the amount of water based on geological features. So even though we have repeatedly been inundated with, we have finally discovered evidence of water on Mars. The evidence has been there for a long time.
So what's the consequence? Why do we care so much about this?
Just the main difference with the current findings is that we're actually encountering the rock outcrops and the settings where the water has ponded, and you can actually see the rocks up close, and you have the real the very fine scale proof that it existed. And there may have been water globally on Mars. It may have only existed in particular places. And if we're going to look for life on Mars, or at least look for fossils from earlier life forms, you want to go to those places that are most likely to have harbored life. And so identifying, for example, a lake bottom or a stream that had flowing water for a significant amount of time, that's really important. And so that's going. Those are the sorts of things that are going to be guiding the next series of missions.
Mm-hmm. For the initial field exploration of Mars and a continuation of this search for not only evidence of life but types of life, then what has happened recently is very, very important. It gives you some very specific types of targets, if not specific targets, for field geological exploration with focused on paleontology. Frankly, sedimentology and paleontology are the two professions that probably the first field geologists on Mars should be specialists in. But if you then take the next step, and assuming that life did get started on Mars,
can we step back for 1 second and say what does life have to do with water? You know, what in other words?
Well,
I'm not sure people would understand that.
As of now, everything we know about life requires some type of interaction with water, water vapor, water films. Water is sort of the common denominator of life forms that we have encountered here on Earth.
So that it makes sense to focus on the existence of water to be, if you're going to search for life, focus on the existence of water to begin with.
Water is an essential ingredient. Uh-huh. There are other essential ingredients to the evolution of life forms, but without water, it is, at least in our perspective as Earthlings, it would be very difficult for life forms to have both come into existence and persisted.
Yeah, in fact, that's the sort of the buzz phrase for the current Mars exploration program. It's follow the water. And it's sort of hedging NASA's...
Like Watergate, follow the money.
Well, yeah, it's hedging NASA's bets. I mean, they don't want to say we're searching for life and only searching for life, because if they find no life, then everyone's disappointed. But water is the pathway that will lead you to evidence for life, if there is evidence.
If you've just tuned in, this is Friday Forum. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've just been listening to Harrison Schmidt, who was the scientist astronaut on Apollo 17. And we're also joined on the program by Carl Agee, who is director of the Institute of Meteoritics here at UNM. And Carl, one of the things about Mars is it wasn't necessarily in its condition, its present condition, say, billions of years ago, right?
Well, that's right. What the Mars exploration rovers are showing, and what, just as Harrison had mentioned, what we believed was the case for, based on orbital imaging, was that Mars was a warmer, wetter place in its ancient past, perhaps somewhat like Earth, with standing bodies of water, with a thicker atmosphere. In other words, a place where life could perhaps form and thrive. And, of course, we'd all like to find fossils to prove that, fossils from the ancient past of Mars. And then also the other part of this search for life has to do with looking for remnants of it. Are there any survivors, any organisms that were able to adapt as Mars became a colder, drier place?
What would be the possible significance to life, to our understanding of life, if we find it on Mars? And how would that impact our understanding of life in general, or life in the universe? Or,
well, as you hinted at in your introduction, if you do the statistics, the probability is quite high that life, not unlike our, based on a chemistry not unlike our own, probably exists in many other places in the universe, some of it younger and some of it much older than ours, and maybe much more advanced than ours. I mean, that's a statistical argument Carl Sagan and many others have made for many years, and is probably valid, although you might revise those statistics downward somewhat because of our increasing understanding of how complex a sequence of events has been in our solar system to ultimately lead to an Earth-like planet that is water-rich and on which life could evolve and be protected. For example, Jupiter is very protective of the Earth. It's been estimated that as many as 1,000 comets a year are picked up by Jupiter that otherwise would impact the Earth. So it's Jupiter. We're very nice to have Jupiter out there. If you want to bow to a god, a planetary god, bow to Jupiter. It's helping out a great deal, and it probably helped out a great deal in our own formation during the very early stages of the of the condensation of the solar nebula. Now, back to the question, though, is that given that the probability is high, if you find that life did get started on Mars, then that reduces the uncertainty of whether life could get started somewhere else.
Because right now we're talking about a case of one.
We're dealing with a case of one. You have a case of two, and it becomes much more philosophically, at least, acceptable to presume that life exists elsewhere in the solar system, in the universe.
Now, I thought I read Carl Ag that that a scientist had looked at a meteor that he had identified as being from Mars and saw fossil remains of life. And right before the show started, you told me that you yourself were the curator for those meteors, right? And you've taken a look at this meteor.
Oh, that's right. This is the the famous Antarctic meteorite that is from Mars. Its name is 84001, and that just is a serial number, basically. 84 meaning that it was collected in 1984. In the season where our researchers went down and hunted for meteorites in Antarctica. That meteorite is at the Johnson Space Center curation facility, and for a couple of years I was curator of that collection as well as the lunar samples. And it was one of the scientists at Johnson Space Center, David McKay, who came forward in 1996 with the claim that this particular Martian meteorite had microfossils in it. And that caused a firestorm of controversy, lots of scientific investigations, debates, and so forth. It's, I would say, right now probably a minority opinion, although it has not been disproven.
Mm-hmm.
We still really need to get more samples from Mars.
We don't have any.
We have the Mars meteorites.
Well, how do we know they're from Mars, by the way?
Well, there are a number of lines of evidence that make people believe that they're from Mars. But in the meteorites themselves, they actually have trapped atmospheric gases. It's locked away in the minerals. And in the laboratory, when these minerals are heated up, those gases escape and they're collected. And we've actually been able to determine that they are identical in chemical and isotopic composition to the Martian atmosphere.
Is there a sample return mission now that's going to be done for Mars?
Well,
that's
really what we need more than anything to answer the question of whether there's life on Mars. We need to get some some good samples that have been collected from sites that are likely to have preserved, again, these fossils, and bring those samples back to Earth so that we can study them in our laboratories where we have scanning electron microscopes. We have all of the state-of-the-art instrumentation to study these. And the sample return mission right now is probably going to take place somewhere around 2013. So it's about 10 years off. And the reason why that is because the sample return mission is going to be the most ambitious robotic space mission that NASA has undertaken. It requires us to go to Mars, collect a sample, launch a rocket off of Mars with the sample and bring it back to Earth. Do that while you keep the sample contained, safe, and clean.
Mars is like 35 million miles away, right?
It depends on where we are.
I see.
It's a long way away.
It's a long way away.
But it can take close to a year to get to get back from Mars. And we can only do it every 2 years. So because of the way that the planets are aligned.
Well, you can launch from here every 2 years, and then you have Mars.
But you just have to wait
at the right time too.
That's
and
right.
You have to wait
That's
and
right.
probably launch
yes.
So 18 months later.
So a whole round trip mission, we're talking about, something like 3 years between start and finish, and that isn't even including the planning that goes into a mission like this. So even though it's 10 years off, the mission planning is starting right now. And so in the next few years, we'll see increased activity. And probably around 2007, there will be an official announcement made, if this all goes forward, whereby there will be a Mars receiving facility set up and all of the various parts of the mission determined.
if I could drag the moon kicking and screaming into this discussion,
the
moon is also interesting.
Well, but it's interesting in this context is that as a result of the analysis of the Apollo samples, the observations and photography that the astronauts took to document those samples on the moon, and subsequent automated missions, orbital missions like Clementine and Lunar Prospector, we have a first-order understanding of the evolution of the moon. Some people say we understand the origin. I'm not one of those. I don't think we do. But that's beside the point in this discussion. The evolutionary sequence, the sequence of events that took place to form the moon and to give it the form that we see today, both externally and internally, has a great deal to tell us about the events that caused Mars to be the way it is today. There are parallels. And in fact, the moon has given us the beginnings of a solar system clock, if you will, because we know we can decipher in general terms the impact history of the moon. And that is the impact history of the inner solar system and clearly relates to Mars and the Earth as well as to the moon in giving us insights into the sequence of events that occurred to create Mars the way it is today.
If you've just tuned in, this is Friday Forum. My name's Stephen Spitz. You just heard Harrison Schmidt talking. Harrison was the scientist astronaut on Apollo 17. And we've also been talking with Carl Agee. And I want to talk about your broader point about life in the universe that you started to begin talking about earlier and mesh it with what we were just talking about. Because one of the things about life in the universe is you need to have, I mean, life here evolved apparently over about 3.8 billion years, and you can't have mass extinction events. You can't have big things hitting planets and expect life. You can't necessarily expect life to continue after that happens, and we know that that happened here on Earth, right?
Well, the our understanding of the history of the impact history of the moon is pretty good, and we know that up until about 3.8 billion years ago, the inner solar system was being bombarded by large objects. Objects that on the moon were capable of producing about 50 basins, impact basins, greater than some 300 kilometers in diameter. The largest of the young basins, again, about almost 3.9 billion years old, the Imbrium Basin is almost 1,000 kilometers in diameter today. And if that was happening on the moon, it was happening on the Earth. There's no question about it. And I don't think it's coincidence that with the termination of that at 3.8 billion years, that period of impact, of intense impacts, we begin to see on Earth the first isotopic evidence of replicating life forms here on Earth. Now, there's some discussion still about that 3.8, the age of the rocks in which they see that isotopic evidence. It's in carbon and oxygen isotopes, and that's being debated still about the exact age. But between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years, there's no question, I think, that life forms begin to appear and survive and replicate on the Earth. What was happening prior to that, we don't know. It may have started and stopped several times, only to be terminated by these very large impacts.
One thing we need to mention in terms of life forms, and this is what we were talking about briefly before the show, are these things called extremophiles, because these are things that did not exist when I was in school. We didn't know about them. And can you just talk to the listeners a bit about what an extremophile is, Harry?
Well, the term has been applied to life forms that like extreme conditions, very hot conditions, very high pressure conditions, relatively speaking, to what we're sensing here in this room. For example, we're finding them life forms that don't even require photosynthesis, that is sunlight, around these deep smokers in the mid-oceanic ridges
miles and miles deep in the oceans, correct?
Very, very deep in the ocean. We also are finding bacterial life, replicating life at about, I think the deepest now is, 4 kilometers?
Yes. They're finding
rocks, in basaltic rocks.
Yeah, in the Columbia River basalts, for
example. Columbia River basalts, in deep granites now, they found some. We're finding them in the hot springs above boiling.
And these were the earliest forms of life on Earth.
Well, maybe. Some of them are speculative that they are related to some of these early forms. But the more important point, I think, is that they tell us that in the extreme conditions of the early Earth, you have a high possibility, at least, of life being able to survive in those extreme conditions.
Which would suggest that perhaps on other planets and other stars, circling other stars,
even on Mars,
sure.
it opens your options for your search for extant as well as fossil life.
Now, when Carl Sagan made his estimate in 74, there weren't any planets discovered, right, Carl, in 74?
Well,
do we know any extra solar planets?
That's right. And so, I mean, we still haven't imaged or detected any Earth-sized extrasolar planets, and that's simply not because they're not there, but it has to do with the resolution, the level of detection that's currently available. But in a few years from now, probably those will start being detected. Now, the question about whether an Earth-like planet is the perfect place for life, that remains an open question.
I mean, but every year we find the Hubble telescope in particular has been finding very, very young sun-like stars with dust halos around them, some of them with gaps where you would expect then condensation of a planet may have already occurred. Right. The evidence is multiplying year by year, particularly with the Hubble telescope work, that sun-like stars with planetary systems around them are not unusual at all in our galaxy or in the universe.
And if you throw in extremophiles, then you've got a greater, quote, habitable zone.
Well, absolutely. For example, we don't even have to think about the inner solar system necessarily. We can take a look at the moons of Jupiter. And those are the so-called Galilean moons. And in particular, Europa is thought to have an icy outer shell, and then below that icy shell may exist a subterranean water ocean. And in fact, you know, if we're talking about organisms that don't require photosynthesis, that survive by chemosynthesis, just like the organisms at the mid-ocean ridges on Earth, we could have, for example. Moons of giant planets, actually, as part of the habitable zone for the solar system, and so even if we're missing, say, for example, an Earth-like planet in another solar system, we might find moons that harbor life.
But for life to actually get started, for complex molecules to form and then reach a point where they actually are replicating molecules, the Earth and Mars as hydrous terrestrial planets, hydrous rocky planets, may offer distinct advantages to life formation. And Europa, although there may be conditions where if you put a bacteria in it, it would survive today, the question is, did it have the conditions that allowed it allowed the complex molecules to gradually get in, increasingly complex and actually become replicating?
Well, actually, it's possible, though, that deep in the core of Europa, there is a little terrestrial planet tucked away in its core.
Well, and this is like the science fiction movie where the intelligent life is living under the surface?
Well, I think that it's – I mean, we know actually at this point very little about Europa. I mean, we essentially just have images of the surface.
I think
when we have a lander down on Europa, that when we drill through the ice and we find out what's below the ice, at that point we'll be able to say. But there's no reason why all of the ingredients for life, why they should be absent. I mean, it's reasonable to consider that all of the organic compounds that went to form the Earth and the other planets are also going to be present in Europa, and so if the conditions were right in Europa and it had enough internal heat and enough of these building blocks for life, it's conceivable that life formed on Europa as well.
I'd like to get you both to talk about life other places outside our solar system in the universe and get your thoughts on that. First to you, Carl, A.G., what do you think?
Well, again, I think it's almost certain that there's life elsewhere. How likely it is, we'll find out first if we find life on Mars or evidence for past life on Mars, then we'll be more confident.
Why do you think it's almost certain?
Well, no, I mean, I think it's almost certain just given the number of stars and galaxies in the universe.
And 15 billion years.
It's just an enormous amount of material and time. And But again, how likely? Well, if we find life or evidence for life on Mars, then we'll say, well, it's pretty likely because we find it in two places in our solar system. On the other hand, if it turns out that Mars is sterile and everywhere else in the solar system is sterile except for Earth, then we'll say, well, then we'll probably conclude that life is not all that likely, or it's very tough to create life from a evolving planet. But again, I think it's almost certain given the number of stars and galaxies. The question really is how nearby is the is this life? If it's very remotely, if it's on some remote star, thousands of light years away from us, it might as well not exist because we'll never be able to detect it or visit such a place. But if it's if it's everywhere in every solar system, then that's very interesting, of course.
The same question to you, Harrison Schmidt, except I throw in another aspect of it, which is if life's out there, intelligent life's out there, how come we don't know about it? How come it hasn't let us know that it exists?
Well, even though the probability is very, very high that there is life as intelligent, more intelligent,